Well, hello, everyone. Today, I get a chance to talk with a new friend who I am just getting to know, Ethan Park. Ethan, you're in Toronto, Canada right now. How are things going?
It's a little bit cold, but it's warmed up today, so I'm going to go outside right after this.
Yeah. Ethan, you know, I've never been to Toronto, right? And so all my friends will say, well, you got to make that trip. You got to drive to Toronto, eat Chinese food, dim sum, and drive right back. But that's the extent I know about Toronto. Tell me about Toronto.
It's one of the most diverse cities I've ever lived in. Toronto wants to be equated with New York and some of the greatest metropolitans in the world, but I wouldn't put it that way. But at the same time, if you want to get a little glimpse of every culture around the world, Toronto is the best place for that. A lot of people have immigrated to the city, so you can have authentic Korean food, authentic Chinese food, all the way to Tibetan food as well. Like every food imaginable is here. It's an aspiring city.
You and I were just talking. You were born and raised in Indiana. You were a Braves fan, the Greg Maddux days, the Tom Glavine, John Smoltz days. But now you're, what made you leave Indiana to move to Toronto?
Good question. I was actually born in South Korea, but I moved to Indiana when I was a preteen. I came up here in time for university. My family moved up here, so that was basically the reason. It was a hard transition coming from growing up in a suburb of Indiana, coming up to Canada. But Canada's been my home for the last 22 years.
Yeah. When you say it was a hard transition, is it hard to transition from Indiana, from the States and all that other stuff? Is life that much different in Toronto?
No, I wouldn't say that. It was more, I think when you're young, when you're aspiring to be something and you have a plan in your mind, it does change a lot when that trajectory changes very quick. So having to adjust to new culture, new nuances, the fact that milk comes in bags instead of cartons, all these little minor differences do make you feel like you're taking a step back. So that was probably the hardest part of just adjusting to the different environment and adjusting my plans and these aspirations that I felt like I had and adjusting to that.
Yeah. Now, Ethan, when especially living life in born and raised in Korea, then going there, what did you think that you were going to do as a career?
Oh, great question. I think as a good Korean kid, I thought that becoming a doctor or a lawyer and going to a specific Ivy League school, I thought that was kind of where I was going to go. I come from a multiple generations of a family of physicians, so I thought that that's what I was supposed to do as well. But I do remember I had lots of aspirations growing up. I remember when I was in kindergarten in Korea, I was during my month of birthdays, we all had to stand up and say what we wanted to be. So we had lots of doctors and engineers and lawyers. And I specifically remember standing up and telling people that I wanted to be a bus driver because I really enjoyed pressing the button to open and close the door. And I remember my kindergarten pastor praying for every single one of us for our dreams, except he skipped over me.
Hey, Ethan, I remember when I was growing up, I really wanted to be a garbage man. And the reason why I wanted to be a garbage man, I love those guys. And back then they had these metallic garbage cans. They would throw and they would throw and they would press a lever and the whole thing would crush. I said, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
100%. And I thought the taxi drivers with their meter, the bus drivers with their levers, I thought those were the best jobs ever.
Yeah. Did you end up like... My parents, when I graduated from high school, says, doctor, lawyer, engineer. Yeah. I had just gotten to Washington University in St. Louis, and they had kind of given me a huge scholarship. And so I got into their, I was a chemistry major. I thought I was going to be a doctor, but that didn't happen. So I ended up being a business major.
That's right. And that's what happened about in grade 10, in my sophomore year in high school, kind of realized, man, like the human body and the biology, it's just pretty icky. That's not what I want to do. But I thought, but creating value, making money and organizing, leading organizations, there's something that I really like about that. So I decided in grade 10 that I was going to change my career trajectory from science-based stuff to business-based career. I knew nothing about business. I knew nothing about it, but I'm glad to be where I am now.
Yeah, yeah. So for university then, I mean, what was your major? Was it business management, accounting, or finance?
Yeah, it's a business school here in Canada called the Ivy School of Business at Western University. It's a 2-year plus 2-year program where first 2 years you just do any program. The third and fourth year we were focused on the business school. So it's a undergraduate level of an MBA school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good. And upon graduation, what was your first job?
Yeah, so my first job was the job that I didn't want to be in. So I initially wanted to run a factory. I really liked operations and efficiency. So that's what I wanted to do. Then I learned about the world of management consulting, where you travel around the world, meet Fortune 500 companies and tell them all the things that they're doing wrong, giving them solutions and actually implementing it. I thought, oh, that's really a fun job, criticizing and critiquing and solving their problems. And not every job is different. I also do like the idea of traveling around. And the one thing that I didn't want to do is to be a finance bro, focusing on finance. But lo and behold, when it was in time for getting a job, there was one job opening at an investment bank. So I thought, okay, well, I got to get a job. So let's apply for that one. The interviews couldn't have gotten worse. It's gone so bad. I did not know how to answer what EBITDA was. I could not answer what market cap was. And the worst of all, it was a second round interview. I'm sitting at the biggest boardroom table I've ever seen in my life. I'm at one end and my interviewer is on the other end. And he says, tell me, Ethan, about how you pay attention to detail. So I gave a very flowery, good business school answer about how, you know, my greatest weakness is being a perfectionist and all that. And as I'm talking, I see the guy, you know, with his head down, like reading through a couple of pages and marking things up. And then when I was done with my answer, he turns the page over, he flips that page back to me and says, hey, you spelled the name of the company wrong on your cover letter. So I told people that I got into finance only because God wanted me to. There was no chance that I would have hired me if I were interviewing me.
Okay, so if you bombed on that interview, why did they pick you? Because what did you show during this interview? You said, whoa, I like this guy.
I don't know. The Lord must have put some favor on me to get the job, either that or... The first choice didn't accept the job. I really don't know to this day, Tommy. I don't know.
Oh, I would have told people it was my stunningly good looks. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
No, look, when I graduated from business school, right, I had to apply for a job. So one of my youth counselors was working at a telecom company called American Tower. It built cell towers. Yeah. So he gets me a job interview, and I get together and I meet with the director of tower operations. His name was Mike. And okay. Mike looks at my resume. He looks at me and says, you have no engineering qualities at all. You didn't study any. So why in the world am I hiring you? Give me one reason. And I said, Mike, there's no reason why you should hire me. I would hire myself, but give me a year and I'm going to work as hard as I can. I'm going to learn everything. And after a year, I will be your best employee. And he says, I like this answer. You're hired. And Ethan, upon my first job, he says, all right, here's what I'm going to do. We just acquired 200 towers from Verizon Wireless. All the files came in, but they're not in order. Go organize that file room. And I'm sitting there, seriously, I'm a WashU grad. You're putting me in the file room. But that was the biggest learning that Lord, wherever you put me, I am going to be faithful. And I'm going to be the best employee in anything you ask me to do. And I was the best file guy, but I didn't realize that 9 months that I was in there laid me the foundation of being so disciplined, so organized, and spotting details that it forced me to do things that I am still doing today.
That's amazing. And I think there was a lot about that for me. Investment banking, working in the mergers and acquisitions as an analyst is not a fun job. You do have to be smart and a hard worker, but you know, you're often at the office from 9 a.m. till 2 in the morning, you know, putting in probably 80, 90, 100 hours a week. And a lot of your job is work that is not fun. It's putting slide decks together. It's changing the numbers. It's putting the, you know, it's a glorified desk of publishing work with a little bit of finance involved in it. But one of the things that I learned is just, immersing yourself in the job, being faithful in what you do, and being a person of integrity, person that does their job well and faithfully, and not playing games that so many others were playing. That people wanted to work with me. People wanted to have me in their files, and they were able to depend on me. I think when I was 15, 16 years old, I thought you are hireable if you are extraordinarily good. And that you have to be the superstar who can dunk from, you know, a 3-point line. But what I've realized is that life's not about the opportunity to dunk from a 3-point line. It's always knowing when to block, how to block, you know, putting the layers, layups in. It's not those glorifying jobs. It's more about faithfulness than being extraordinary at a precious moment.
Yeah. And Ethan, if you look back, who taught you some of that? Was it watching your parents? Was it a teacher? Was it a youth counselor, a youth pastor? Who instilled those values in you that made you sit there in the early years and work so many hours and really was focused?
I don't know. That's a great question. I think definitely work ethics came from my family, just seeing how they work. It's also on the faithfulness of all the other people that has built into me, from church, from my church youth group, all the way to mentors that I've had. But a lot of that has also been just God working on my heart to be faithful in what I do and being and tasked that has given. I think there was definitely ambition in my heart, wanting to get to places, but it was more about getting stuff done and being a reliable coworker rather than playing games to get ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned one word a lot of times is, and even with all of our different leaders who are listening to this podcast, ambition. Is there a difference for you as God's ambition, holy ambition versus the worldly ambition? How do you differentiate the two?
Ooh, that's a great question. I need to think about this, but when you are building your own ego, your own name, and things that is attached to your own accomplishment, I think those are worldly egos. I think even in ministry, even in serving God, I think we can do that for our own edification. And I think about the ego of the older son in the parable of the prodigal sons. I think there was ego involved, that he was faithful for himself, not for his father. Yeah. And I think there is ambition that it, a lot of our ambition, even if it's well-serving, I think can be bad. But I also see people like Daniel, who were faithfully doing their work for the Lord. Was he ambitious? I don't know, but I think he got put into those places as a result of his faithfulness. And I think Joseph, he was faithful in what he was doing, that he got put into a place where he could help the Israelites. I think godly ambition is led by the Holy Spirit and God himself rather than us wanting to get to that place.
Yeah. I watch a guy, I mean, even when Daniel recently, a guy who passed away was Tim Keller. From watching from afar and sitting in meetings, I still remember when he was talking with someone about what it means to be secure and who God has made you to be. And no matter how big the ministry got, you just were secure that I am a steward of what God has given. But there's a confidence of these are the skills and gifts God has given me. And you do it. And so for some skills, it's making money. Do it the best you possibly could. Some people are good at this and that, but it's being confident, but knowing I'm doing it for the Lord, to honor the Lord in everything I do, versus more power, more money, all of those different things. That becomes a worldly ambition.
Yeah. And I think trying to be ambitious in the main goal is not the point. I think the result of ambition is a byproduct of your faithfulness. I think a lot of times we want to be fill in the blank rich. We want to be have lots of followers. I think there's a lot of these result-oriented goals that we have, but those are byproducts of our faithfulness. And I think we need to allow God to direct us so that we may be able to see some of the impact that, that God is allowing us to do. I think a lot of times we focus on impact more than we focus on faithfulness.
Yeah. Hey, so even for you, a lot of times is, how long did you stay where you were in that part, that first job? And did you move from job to job to end up what you're finally doing right now?
Great. So I quit my job in 2008, in September 2008. So for some of us that are beginning to have gray hair, 2008 was a difficult year for the financial industry. So the Friday before, the Friday is when I put in my resignation, my 4-week notice. And I quit my job without having a place to go. And I was engaged to my wife, my fiance then. So I thought between working 100 hours a week versus being married and not working 100 hours a week, I chose marriage. And I quit my job, put in the resignation on that Friday, and I came back on Monday. And by Monday morning that day was when Lehman Brothers have fell apart. It was a tumultuous time for sure in the financial industry, but I quit my job on Friday before Lehman Brothers fell apart.
Hey, random question. Before Lehman Brothers on that Monday, was there any rumors? Did you have any hints something was happening?
I think there were people, I was a lowly analyst that didn't get that kind of information, but, I remember turning my BlackBerry off for the first time, came back to the office, and I remember my boss telling me, "Hey, did you see the news? The entire world's falling apart."
Yeah.
And it was scary.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
After this job, now you quit, you got married.
Yeah.
What next? Where'd you end up?
One of the things I thought about is, I served in the church. I took a little sabbatical. First year marriage was great to serve together with my bride on a local church. But as I was thinking about the next phase, I thought, well, hedge fund, the investment banking world was great, but rather than being a seller in the marketplace, I want to be a steward in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a buy side and a sell side. The sell side sells products to the buy side, and buy side stewards the resources that someone has entrusted to them. And I thought, I'm not very good at sales, but I'm pretty good at, managing something. I'm good at managing to make sure that we're not spending as much and making the right decision for it. So one thing led to another. I wanted to be in the buy side industry and met two other friends, actually three other friends back then, to start a hedge fund. By then my wife and I had our first kid. A daughter was born in 2010, and that December in 2010, the four of us got together, talk about starting a hedge fund together.
Yeah. And that's a little uncertain, right? Because when you're single, you kind of do whatever you want. But now you're married, you're having a daughter, you're saying, what if it doesn't work?
Yeah. It's funny because I'm too stupid to think about the cost. So that the idea of starting something was interesting. But the Tommy, you're right. The first 3-4 years of being in a startup fund was scary. Yeah. Not to mention that we had a newborn daughter. We were trying to figure out what it meant to be a parent, what it meant to be a supportive spouse to one another. It was a difficult time as we were trying to build this business, and it was not easy.
Got it. Now, is that the same business that you're still running to this day? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And did it? Even with this business, did it go well right away? He says, okay, this is great. Or did it start slow where it was lean years and you had to work through your way through all these things?
It was difficult for the first 5-6 years. And back then, by 2013, I had my son. We were very young. The business was very young. And I remember thinking on our first night away with my wife and I, after my son was born, I remember praying to God, I need to get to work. I need this to be successful. I know I know the path that you're giving me. I'm going to put my head down and get to work. Just tap on my shoulder when you want to look up, but I'm getting to work. I remember praying that prayer, and I remember how difficult it was just to navigate all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Was your wife working at that point in time as well, too? And you guys had to work? Or, she was at home with the kids. Okay. Yeah. And I say this a lot of times, Ethan, because my wife is a first grade teacher. She still is a first grade teacher. In the first couple of years with Resource Global, where we work with young Christian marketplace leaders in different global cities, I used a lot of my personal support to really be able to get started. But then we depend on her insurance. And when I was bringing my first year, I earned zero. Then I earned $9,000. Then I earned $15,000. I earned nothing the first 3 years. So we had to depend on her. Mm-hmm. And I think she finally got tired of it. And then I got cancer. And we were just starting our first cohort in Jakarta. And she says to me, I want you to get a real job because this is just a little too taxing on this. We can't do this anymore. And I really thought I was just going to quit. I'm going to finish up my first 8-month cohort with these folks in Jakarta and then start because I was gone for cancer. Lo and behold, that's really how God started working. He took that first cohort in Indonesia and grew it to where it's right now. And he did it in ways I can't even imagine. It was completely different than how I was. I thought I was going to shut this thing down.
Yeah. No, Tommy, that's so funny you say that because it was hard. It was definitely really hard. And definitely thought crossed my mind of, hey, if I had a real job, as you call it, I wouldn't have that stress that I do now. It's definitely that thoughts that came through my head daily, if not more. But that's funny, hey. I think when I was kind of getting out of university, getting ready for the workforce, I thought I knew it all. Mm-hmm. I thought that the rest of your life from 22 to death was gonna be all happy story. That's straight linear line. But little did I know that God had a major journey for me. My thinking, my views, it was still evolving. And it still is evolving and it will continue to evolve. And I think that journey that God has on each one of us is unique and it'll never be stale. And looking back, I can see God's fingerprint on every major and minor decisions that's happened throughout my entire life.
And that's the one thing, even with some of our young leaders that I encounter is they say, Tom, I really want to know what God's calling me to do. I really want to know where, but my seminary professor says to me, Tommy, you have to learn how to reflect and you have to see God working throughout your life and the lessons that he was teaching you every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And if you do not learn how to reflect, you will truly never understand what God was trying to do. I had to force myself to learn how to reflect on those things.
Yeah, it's funny. I own a puppy, so now he's a dog. But I've
I hear him.
Yeah, sorry. He is still an energetic 8-year-old puppy. But I remember when I first got him, he was full of energy. So he would pick up some words, and if he hears the word park or walk, he gets very excited and he was ready to bolt. And if I let him, he probably would have ran to the park and waited at the door until I showed up. But as the dog is getting older and wiser, he's perfectly happy now to walk right next to me, looking up and walking alongside me when he's going for walks. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something that God taught me in seeing my puppy like that. I think when we are young, we want to know the destination. And as soon as we know the destination, we feel certain of it. We have to run as fast as possible. And when if the door is still closed, we expect God to open it up ASAP because we're already here. And we miss out on the intimacy to get there.
Yeah.
But the old, wiser dogs, they're so much happier being right at the heel of your master, walking alongside, stopping when the master stops, knowing that he protects you, knowing that he's going to look after you, and he's going to take you to places even greater than what you can imagine. And I think that comes through reflection and knowing and trusting God. And I remember, especially in the younger phases of my life, wanting to know the surety of my future because I wasn't willing to trust God. I don't think I would have said that when I was 20. But looking back, I didn't trust God. And as I'm a 40-year-old looking for the next 40 years, I don't trust God what it's going to happen in the next 40 years. I think I gave up more of that. I trust God in some parts, but I don't trust God in all the parts. And the older and wiser people before me are telling me that journey continues in understanding in our good God who knows and cares for you in all things.
And Ethan, even as I hear you talk, it takes time, doesn't it? Because look at what you were born and raised in Korea, then you went to Indiana, then you went to Toronto, then you got your first job in the area of finance that you never even wanted to touch before, then you quit your job, then you worked at a church, then you start. It takes time. It really takes time.
Yeah.
And then also, like, did you grow up, even now, are you in a Korean church right now?
No.
Okay, got it. And the reason why I ask you this is, do people at church know what you do for, like, when they sit there and hear you and you're working the business world and all that stuff, do pastors, Christians, or churches understand what you're trying to do? Because sometimes for me, I don't think a lot of times the pastors or ministry leaders I talk with know what to do with me and have an idea what I actually do.
I Tommy, I agree with you on that. I think the general tendency that I experience, I'm not going to speak for the entire church, is that there's an expectation that if you're called into secular work, then you should go and work in the secular work and then make money and then bring it back to the church. I think there's a better way to live than that. Your secular work is a calling. Your secular work is a place to actually adjust and apply the principles of the kingdom. That is so different. And if you're not facing those conflicts of your faith and who you and the dynamics within the secular work, then you're not looking hard enough, and you're not applying the kingdom principles in everyday decisions, every second decision you make in the secular world. I think we need to do more of that. I think we need to, as secular workers, our worship is in being faithful to our work and seeing that God has called us to do that work and see that we are an extension of God providing his common grace to the entire world through what we do. And if we don't see that, and if we're too ambitious to play the game that the rest of the world plays in our workplace, then we're no different than we're no different than living the ways of the world, but we're called to live the world ways of the kingdom.
You look at Matthew, right? Matthew and Zacchaeus, both were tax collectors. One was called to pack up everything and to follow him. The other one, Jesus says, hey, look, let me come over to your house. But he doesn't ask him to follow him. He asks him to stay at his job. Was Matthew better than Zacchaeus? No, they were the same. They were just called to two different things.
Secular vocation is very, very sacred. I think a lot of us have been told that, you know, work is what we do to live. But it's the other way around, in my opinion. Work is what we live to do. And when we start thinking about our work as something that's part of who we are, then a lot of our thoughts change. I think by my calculation, every person that works probably spends 30 to 50% of your awake time every week on work.
Yeah.
And applying our Jesus's way of living into that time frame is such an important part of what we're called to do as believers.
Yeah. Hey, time's running out. We're going to have to do this again because it was very, very easy talking with you. I want to ask you one question and we'll come back. You look back at your startup, all of that stuff, and you probably made a lot of good decisions, but you probably made a lot of bad decisions along the way, mistakes. If you could look back and make correct one mistake that you could have done better, what would it have been?
I go back to that prayer that my declaration to God in 2013. God, I need to get to work. Tap on my shoulder. This idea of I'm going to study at the library, like tap on me when I'm done. I think I pushed God to say, God, I'm going to run next few years. I'm the puppy. I'm going to get to that destination. You just meet me when you want me to reconnect with you. I didn't run away from God. I it's not like I rejected God, but I didn't let him come to be part of my daily co-walker in that journey. I said, God, I know my journey. I know where I need to go. Meet me at the flip side. And I think that if I were to redo it, I think the walk that I did for those 5 years, when I made that prayer until when God tapped on my shoulder, I think that would have been easier and that would have been more fulfilling.
Got it. Yeah. Very, very good. Ethan, we're going to have to do this again. Thank you so much for this.
Blessings.